I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, Douglas Valentine, author of the groundbreaking book The Phoenix Program, joins us once again, this time in light of the republication of another one of his books, namely TDY. Now, if you're unfamiliar with Douglas, much of his work deals with subjects like covert operations, the CIA, and the Vietnam War. In this conversation, we discuss all of those subjects. But we also get a little bit more philosophical, and even bring in the work of Guy Debord, author of The Society of the Spectacle, to try and answer the question, how in the world did we get to the present moment where secrecy, terror, and fear reign supreme? All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now on to my conversation with Douglas Valentine, author of TDY, The Phoenix Program, and a number of other fascinating books on issues related to covert operations, Vietnam, and the CIA. And now, a word from our sponsor.
My name is Joseph L. Flatley, and I'm a journalist who specializes in conspiracy theories and French culture. Over the years, I've met cultists and occultists, flat earthers, and doomsday bunker salesmen, to name only a few. One thing I hear often is that the end of the world is near, and these days, you have to wonder if there might be some truth to that. My new podcast is called Failed State Update. Through interviews and original reporting, each episode asks the question, is the world ending, or does it just seem like it is? Think of it as fresh air for the Orwellian dystopia we've suddenly found ourselves in. Available now on iTunes, Spotify, Anchor, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Parallax Views. Douglas Valentine, author of a number of books, including the recently re-released TDY. I guess the thing about your work, Douglas, is that it covers issues like covert ops, the war in Vietnam, the CIA, but the real general gist is the topic of secrecy and what it means to our society and our lives.
Yeah, it all started, you know, with my first book about my father. My father was a World War II veteran. I knew that. But I never knew that he was a prisoner of war. And he had bad PTSD. And his problems with what happened to him in the war affected everybody in my family. And I could see that other veterans, World War II veterans who had PTSD, that they had their trauma had a similar effect on the families of my friends, you know, growing up as a kid. And you could see how having been part of the military and involved in combat and seeing all that death and destruction can harm a person and do them psychological damage. But it's not just that. The veteran projects his damage onto his family. And when you have thousands and thousands or millions of veterans in a society, then the whole society becomes damaged from that war experience. Plus which, my father had been involved, had been a prisoner of war. And the existence of this prison camp was covered up by the military. This is not unusual. The military in World War II covered up a number of prison camps because of the war was going on at the time, or they just didn't want people, potential recruits, to know what could possibly be in store for them if they became a prisoner of war. Okay, so there were, you know, for psychological reasons, prisoners were often made to sign non-disclosure statements and not talk about what happened to them in prison camps. Okay, and at the age of 31, when I was 31, my father told me that he had been in a prison camp, and he had had to keep this secret all his life. So on top of just being a combat veteran and seeing the traumas of war, he had also had to keep a lot of things secret. And all this contributed to his PTSD and the trauma that everybody in my family experienced. And when he finally revealed what happened to him in this prison camp, when he exorcised those demons from him at the express direction of his surgeons, his doctor said, if you don't talk about this, you're going to die. He had had a couple of open heart surgeries. You know, I mean, that's how serious it affected him, that if you don't talk about it, you'll never get better. And so he told me about it. And in the process, we had hated each other. You know, I hadn't talked to him in 10 years. And we repaired our personal relationship. And he took responsibility. He said, I was the adult. I'm the father. I projected all my problems on you and my family. And it was my responsibility to tell you people what really happened and to get over my problems and not be afraid of what the government was going to do to me if I told you, you know. So he went through a catharsis that very few veterans go through, okay? Very few people who've been in these kind of situations, you know, Holocaust survivors don't go around talking about it because they have survivor's guilt. They survived and they did things that were terrible in order to survive, and they just don't want to talk about it. But you got to talk about these things if you want to heal. And so my books become allegorical. The CIA dominates our society by keeping its operations secret, the things that it does in our name. Okay? And these are very terrible things, criminal things, war crimes, those policy. And so we don't know what's going on. And it makes us superficial. We superficially feel good, you know, like we have a happy family. But if you start revealing what's really going on in our name, then that can cause a kind of trauma. You know, are we really responsible for these things that the CIA is doing? And so the books I write are allegorical about the tensions and the problems within our society as a result of the secret things that our government does in our name. And this latest book, TDY, is another allegory about how being involved in a secret operation affects a person as an individual, but also how it divides the country and how it creates, sectarianism, and how it creates a reliance, the kind of reliance that you see nowadays in Trump supporters on a kind of magical, mystical thinking about things, rather than taking a scientific, practical approach to things and trying to get at the source of what's going on, like we see with COVID. Don't rely on science. You're okay, go out and do whatever you want to do, because there's things that are more important than life, and there's our magical things that are more important than life. There are things that aren't real. And yet, if people can believe in these fictions, they can be made to do just about anything, and they will do just about anything. And how the society, the secrecy is part of psychological warfare that our rulers wage against us in order to motivate us and get us to do things that are against our own self-interest. Okay, and all this stuff is wrapped up together, and you need to be scientific about it and study it, and not just believe things, but really get into it in a psychological, sociological, technological, bureaucratic way, and unravel it to find out what it is that we can, just the way, like with my father having to reveal what really happened to him, the kind of cathartic experiences, self-examinations that we have to go through in order to heal our society, so that we can stop being self-destructive, so that we can be have a government that actually looks out to protect our health, and how we can demand that kind of a government that that really serves our interests rather than the interests of our Mandarin class. So all these things are connected together, and it's really complex. And it's a lot easier to say, well, I believe in God, and God's going to find a way. God has a plan. Let me tell you, God doesn't exist. And if you want to get things done, you got to take matters into your own hands. And, we have to work together and solve things scientifically.
Would it be okay? I'm curious. You were talking about your first book, Hotel Tacloban, about your father. And you mentioned how the trauma of returning soldiers, it gets passed on in a way to the family members, the relatives, and it infects the broader society, that trauma. Maybe you could elaborate on that point.
Sure. Civilians, by and large, have no idea what it means to be in combat. It's like a man can't, no matter how, you might be pregnant for a birth of a child, but you don't go through 9 months of labor. And you don't know what it feels like to carry a fetus around in your body and then a baby and to give birth. So there's certain gender experiences that are particular to that gender. And by and large, combat has been a male experience, all right? So sons and daughters who haven't experienced combat want to relate to the experience that their husbands and fathers and sons have gone through, okay? But they can't. So they empathize, and myths like your one of your previous guests, Jerry Lemke, talked about people, civilians try to relate to what happened to soldiers, okay? And rather than ask, well, what actually happened in the war, they cling to representations of war. Okay, for example, a wife feels that her Vietnam veteran husband was spit on when he came home from Vietnam. You know, now the fact of the matter was that nobody was spit on, but they believe that Vietnam veterans were mistreated. And in this way, they confer a kind of victimhood onto their husbands for having been part of this you know, really horrible, aggressive imperial war overseas. And in that way, they're able to make a connection with them, which they could not make otherwise. They make an empathetic connection to their soldier, husband, father, son, by feeling sympathy for them for this particular reason, that they were victims and that they were trying to protect the rest of America. Okay, now, by and large, that's a lot of BS. Okay, they weren't protecting America from anything. Okay, but these myths are created by the military establishment through propaganda, through psychological warfare, to enable civilians to empathize with soldiers and confer upon them some either sympathy or heroism or some way of connecting with them other than what is actually going on. Okay, so that they can, so that the very nature of America's militaristic society can go on, can be perpetuated. Okay, so these myths are created for civilians to connect with soldiers, and soldiers by and large have no way of communicating veterans what it was actually like. So they either accept it. You know, when soldiers by and large do not need somebody saying to them, thank you for your service. When that's something that is enables the civilian to connect to the soldier. Okay. Otherwise, you know, I mean, soldiers don't sit down when they're together and say, thank you, Joe. Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Bob. You know, they don't need a thank you. Not really, not from each other. They had an experience, but they do also want psychologically to connect with their families and to have some sort of status because of what they did. So all these myths grow up around it. And as little boys, these myths, very much the secrecy that surrounds what actually happens in war and what it really means, this is the very core of what it means to be an American male. Okay? And you grow up with these myths of John Wayne, of heroism, of fighting to defend our country. And these things are ingrained in the American male, and they perpetuate the patriarchy. They perpetuate misogyny. They perpetuate all sorts of really negative aspects of American society. And it's all interconnected, and it's all manipulated by our Mandarin class.
If I could, I want to riff on that for a brief moment here. I think this mythology, these myths, are also the seed for fascism. To me, fascism, in all the studies I've done, is related to sort of a mytho-poetic way of thinking. It's a desire for ultra-national palingenesis, or the rebirth of the nation, and it becomes a way to justify all manner of horror. You know, we can go into Vietnam, we can go into the Philippines and wreck the lives of countless innocents and peasants because this is what God and country wanted us to do. And that is what justifies the secrecy, this desire for this national rebirth.
Yeah, sure. You know, and the what we're seeing today, right now in America, is actually, you know, the result of all this having gone on and out for the last 75 years, since the result of World War II. Okay. And Trump represents, and again, it's the same guy that Guy Debord, who you quoted at the beginning of this, when he's the guy that said secrecy dominates our world, foremost as the secret of domination. How we don't know how we're dominated. Okay, and that's the core of the secrecy. But he also said that people in the spectacle that we live in, and our society is can be understood as a spectacle where people relate more to the representation than they do to the reality of things. Okay, because there is, and this, you know, connects to what we're talking about. People do not have the time to dissect everything that's going on in the spectacle. They don't have the time to really investigate racism or the issues around abortion or the meaning and the symbolism of carrying a gun, the nature of military propaganda, the nature of religion, the nature of capitalism as opposed to communism. People can't sit down and study all these things. And so based on what their beliefs are, they look for somebody to represent them. Okay. And somebody like Trump comes along who has no connection in reality to any of his 44 million, 60 million followers. I mean, this is a guy who in reality does not ascribe to any of the things that he represents. And yet in the society of the spectacle, he is followed blindly by 60 million people who merely because he does represent their beliefs. He doesn't embody them. He doesn't hold them true to himself. And if they were to actually study him in a scientific way, they would find out that he's just manipulating them. But none of that really matters in our society today. And this is what enables fascism to occur. Is because people are not scientifically studying every part of their life within this sort of, you know, scientific method of trying to understand things. They are just simply believing things. And this is what Mussolini, which was the source of his strength, Hitler, the source of his strength. Hitler kept telling the German people that they were special, that they, you know, they were superior, that they, you know, had a right to oppress lesser people. You know, all these sorts of things that you see going on in America right now with Trump's followers. And it's sectarian, and it's a very narrow way of thinking about things. But the beliefs that these people have, and, you know, the things that they believe in, did not occur overnight. They weren't, you know, rabbits pulled out of a magician's hat. These are the things that have been ingrained in people in America for the last 75 years as truth. And they're constantly reaffirmed in many ways through the media, through the way the social organization, through, every part of the spectacle that what they're thinking is true. Okay. And so it becomes, you know, people live in this, like, again, what Guy Debord said, a representative world where truth is really has no meaning anymore. Okay. And this is the problem that media people are constantly confronted with Trump, because they can't discuss this in the kind of depth that it needs to be to be discussed in order for it to lead people out of this illusion this grand illusion that we're in right now. And that's how fascism occurs.
Right. It brings to mind an old quote, and I forget who said it first, but it's almost as if we live in a world at times where our masters, our sort of overlords, have made it so that we think black is white and white is black. It's all very bizarre. We live in this world of illusions. I'm curious, how do we get there when it comes to these agencies like the CIA? I feel like Edward Lansdale is a key figure in a lot of this.
Well, after World War II, the United States alone possessed atomic weapons. Okay, and it could... it ended World War II by dropping atomic weapons on Japan. And there was this feeling that the United States was now going to rule the world. Okay, and it had in World War II, it had after World War II was over, it found itself occupying Germany, it found itself occupying Italy, occupying Japan. And in order, it had military bases in all in these countries, and it found itself actually physically in a position where it dominated the world. And then in 1949, I think it was, Russia gets an atomic bomb. And now all of a sudden, there's this kind of balance of terror. And once this happened, once the communist Soviet Union got atomic weapons, the nature of reality changed. And as a 70-year-old minute, he said, social and political and ethnic manipulations are now more important than atomic weaponry. And we entered the era of the Cold War, where both the Soviet Union and the United States had to focus on propaganda as a way to get people to do what they wanted to do. Okay, and this became the focus of this propaganda war, what was called political and psychological warfare, manifested itself in Vietnam in 1955. Okay, Vietnam was split in half, and North Vietnam was given by China and Great Britain and the United States to the communists under Ho Chi Minh, okay? Godless communism, the antithesis of American freedom. And the South Vietnam was given to what was called the Free World Forces. And the CIA then began to experiment in a way it had never experimented with before, with how to socially and politically manipulate a society in South Vietnam. South Vietnam became the petri dish for how the CIA was going to perfect political and psychological warfare techniques in order to prevent the communist North from taking over, all right, and reunifying the country. And they did this initially by installing a Catholic president named Diem in South Vietnam. Okay, I mean, it was a sham election in 1955, and 99% of the people voted for this Catholic, even in a country that was 90% Buddhist. Okay, and there was nobody else ran against them, and the CIA just, you know, installed a Catholic president in South Vietnam. And maybe 750,000 Catholics fled from North Vietnam to South Vietnam, and the CIA installed these people in top administrative positions in South Vietnam. Okay, so they sort of like a colonial government anywhere historically does. They created a class of suppletives, an administrative class that would do its bidding. Okay, they were given special privileges. They were taught how to, you know, put in positions of in charge of government. They, the CIA created the Vietnamese Information Service. It created the Vietnamese State Department. It created all its civic and government institutions in South Vietnam, and it started at the top, organizing a society from the top down. In the meantime, the communists were organizing the South Vietnamese society from the peasant villages up. Okay, they actually had the support of the peasantry in South Vietnam, the communists did. So right away, the CIA had to find a way to try to convince the 90% of the country that wasn't, you know, on its payroll, that they should support American policies in South Vietnam. And this is where it begins its policies of, it developed its policies that you can see actually be playing out here in the United States nowadays of political and social control. How do you get people to do things that are against their own interest. Okay, and it was, they had, the CIA did this in South Vietnam through two primary methods. Through its foreign intelligence branch, which worked with the South Vietnamese police. Okay, they created a South Vietnamese FBI, which they called the Special Branch of Police. And the Special Branch of the Police had control of looking for these Vietnamese cadres who were trying to organize the villages. And they had control in villages that were controlled by the South Vietnamese government. And then the CIA, through the second way it was doing this, was through its covert action branch. And the covert action branch was basically operated under cover of civic action. And it would go into villages which were controlled by the communists. Okay, it would send in what were called armed propaganda teams. And they would go in and they would try to convince through political speech. And if that didn't work through terrorism, actually killing the cadres in that village or initially just dropping a bomb on that village, that the people should switch their allegiance from the Viet Cong and from the communists to the government of South Vietnam. So there was the carrot and the stick. All right. That did not work. And in 1963, they realized that having a Catholic president was only alienating people. And the CIA arranged for Diem's assassination. And within a year, actual war broke out in South Vietnam. Okay. There was an insurgency began. And all the communist-controlled villages started actually organizing guerrilla units, which were, you know, starting to fight the government of South Vietnam and its forces. And forces from North Vietnam started coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail and pouring into South Vietnam through Laos and Cambodia. And by 1965, the United States realized the only way it could save South Vietnam was by sending soldiers to South Vietnam. And so in October of 1965, Marines land in Da Nang, which is right up where the demilitarized zone was separating North and South Vietnam. And by 1967, there's 500,000 American soldiers in South Vietnam. The only way that they can save this colony is through 500,000 American soldiers fighting there and defending it, because they could not convince most of the peasants to go against their own self-interest. They could, you know, the peasants were actually helping the communists. There were thought to be 75,000 communist cadres in South Vietnam who were organizing this insurgency. Okay, so in 1967, the CIA decides they can't win the war unless they kill off these 75,000 cadres who are organizing the villages against South Vietnam. And that is when they create the CIA, the Phoenix Program, which is targeted through the use of the Foreign Intelligence Special Police and its covert action branch to bring together all the different forces, paramilitary, intelligence, military, police, and focus them on killing these 75,000 cadres in South Vietnam as the only possible way to win the war. And that's how that happens. In the meantime, they have to continue through psychological warfare to go after the other 5 million people and convince them that they should support the government of South Vietnam. And and that's where the CIA perfects its methods of political and social control. How do you convince people to go against their own self-interest? And it's there in that petri dish of South Vietnam through the Phoenix Program that it devises all the political and psychological methodologies which, you know, I discuss in my book, The Phoenix Program, about how you actually control a society.
You know, I don't want to get too deeply into the Phoenix program. You've talked about it a lot on other programs, but I do want to ask you this. So after the book on your father, the Hotel Tacloban, you decide to do this book on the Phoenix program. And William Colby actually, I think, calls you up. Your wife answers, and you know, you end up working with Colby on this book, and he was heading up the Phoenix program. What I want to know is, how did these people in the CIA that you spoke to for this book, which was very heavily footnoted, very well researched, how do they think? I want to get inside the mind of these CIA figures that were behind the Phoenix program, because it's such a terrifying program to me, and it confuses me how they couldn't see how terrifying it was.
Well, you know, I mean, there was a phenomenon then at the time. And again, Lemke, you know, your former boss got into it. There had been a generation gap before the world between the World War II veterans and the Vietnam veterans. All right, the kids that had to go off and fight in Vietnam. And World War II was a justifiable war. It could, you could say that Americans were fighting to defend the world from fascism, and they were a force for good. But you could not say that about Vietnam. Okay, it was obvious on the surface. The things that I'm talking about now were well known during the Vietnam War. But the guys who went and served in Vietnam, and they did so for many, many different reasons. You know, it wasn't all the same. You know, some of them just got drafted. Some of them were true believers. Some of them wanted to prove that, felt that the only way they could prove they were a man was by going and killing commies for Christ. You know, I mean, there was a lot of different reasons for guys going there, but they all thought they were going to win. You know, and then when they came home and they didn't win, well, how do you deal with that? And so there was this generation gap that between the World War II generation and my generation. And when William Colby as an individual was experiencing this on a personal basis. He had children who were my age, and his son didn't like him because of what he was doing. I mean, Colby was always testifying before Congress about what a good program Phoenix was, and how really nobody was supposed to get hurt. And, you know, it was really for God and for country. And, you know, I mean, it was just lying, you know, the way Trump does, just lie after lie after lie, and everybody could see through it. And Colby's daughter had a young daughter who basically committed suicide because she, through anorexia, she was so disturbed. And again, it's this, the secrecy, the falsifications had an effect on Colby's family, just like my father's problems had an effect on my family. And it was spread throughout the country at the time. All right. And so Colby saw me as a representation of his son, of the younger generation, and as a way for the older World War II generation to connect with the younger generation. If I could be a vehicle for talking about why these guys did what they did, why these CIA officers did, and almost to a man, and they were all men, they all had children my age, and they were all having the same disconnects with their children as I was having with my father. And so I became like a surrogate, an avatar for them psychologically to try and repair and heal relationships with their own family. You know, so there were all sorts of strange psychological things going on every time I went and would talk with one of these CIA officers, because Colby had sent me. And so they thought I carried his imprimatur, and I must be CIA, I must be sympathetic. And it was a cathartic event for all of these people on an individual level to talk with me. Okay. And that's why I got to where I got. That's why I was able to get all this information. But at the same time, you know, it's when Trump said about the events in Charlottesville. He said, you know, there were Nazis down there, and they attacked people who were demonstrating against fascism. And one of the demonstrators was killed. And people were looking for Trump to say, you know, these are bad people. And Trump said, no, there's a lot of fine people there amongst them, okay, among the fascists. And it's true, okay? All these CIA people invited me into their homes. Some of them were deeply involved in their churches, whether they're the Catholic Church or the Presbyterian Church. These were guys who, if their neighbor's house was on fire, would rush out the door and rush into their neighbor's house and save the wife and kids. All right? Good people. And when Trump says that about, you know, the guys carrying guns into the Michigan State House, this is what he, you know, the militia guys that come in armed to the teeth, and, you know, and they force their way into the State House in Michigan, and they call for the, you know, basically to hang the governor and stuff like that. Trump says, well, these are good people. It resonates with them because they do feel like what they are doing is good. And they feel that this is, you know, what they're doing is to defend their wives and their kids. And they feel like the guns that they carry are a symbol and a representation of their manliness, of their ability to protect their wives and their kids from basically, you know, black rappers, gangsters, you know, who might come into their neighborhood and steal their refrigerator at night, you know, or something like that. And so they feel that they're honestly good people. And these things that they're doing are, you know, so when Trump talks to them and he says, well, they're good people, it's true and it resonates with them. But how do you actually know in this world of the spectacle we're in? How can you actually determine that these things that you believe as a militiaman taking over the state capitol and carrying guns are not actually in your own self-interest? That it's really just for an interest, you know, the interest of your own small group, whether they're Catholics or Protestants or white people or anti-abortion people. You know, I mean, you can't tell an anti-abortion woman that it's complicated, you know, and that maybe women need to be able to have safe abortions. You know, it's just cut and dry. No, they don't want them. And when Chris Matthews, you know, I mean, this was one of the original indications of where Trump was at. And when he was campaigning, Chris Matthews said to him, so do you think that women who get abortion should be punished? And Trump said, yes. You know, that women who get abortions. And so right away, he endeared himself with 60 million Americans who really believe that. And they think that they're good people for believing that. You know, I mean, so this is the bind that we're in. It's called a double bind, where you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And it is part of the social and political manipulation that we're subjected to. The fact that our society has been split down the middle, and it's by design in order to keep the left and the right fighting against each other so that nobody can ever actually work for their own collective common self-interest, you know, and the political and the psychological manipulation fuels all the sectarianism and keeps us all at each other's throats.
One thing that's really interesting to me is you've talked to CIA people, you've talked to William Colby. When I've read people like William Colby or James Angleton or the writings of the Dulles brothers, the thing I notice is that their thinking is not necessarily complicated or complex. It's actually it's black and white. It's us or them. And it's just, it's very interesting to me how people can fall into that line of thinking, because it's really not, it's such a simplistic way of viewing the world, and I think it's very dangerous.
Sure, and that's because these people, like the Dulleses, or Lansdale, or Trump, or Obama, do not have, they're not the technicians. These are not the guys that went to Harvard and studied, Harvard, Yale, and studied organizational behavior. They are not the anthropologists or the sociologists that study scientifically how to organize, how to use people's beliefs against them. That's not their function in this society that's been created. They have a more general function. They don't have to know the detail. But when the CIA, when Lyndon Johnson said, find a way to pacify the Vietnamese people, okay, and in 1967, he sent a guy out to South Vietnam named Robert Cover, whose job was to create a general staff for pacification. How to convince all the South Vietnamese people to come over to the American beliefs. Okay, now Americans are running the war. They're not South Vietnamese. How can they connect to people? How can they connect to South Vietnamese people? Well, Buddhists, completely different culture. Well, you have to do it through systems. Okay, so they hire a guy named Nelson Brickham, who was a Yale graduate, and he was considered an organizational genius. And he is the person that organizes this general staff for pacification. And it becomes called the Intelligence Coordination and Exploitation Program, ISICS, which was then later renamed Phoenix, because Phoenix is, again, magical thinking. It represents something. It represents a country being born from the ashes of, a war and reforming itself. And this guy, Nelson Brickham, is a technocrat. And he knows how Ford Motor Company organizes to sell Fords. And he organizes the Phoenix program the same way, to sell American beliefs to the South Vietnamese people. So organizations, bureaucracies are put in place, and how they are used is determined by people like Alan Dulles, Edward Lansdale. They're not the people that put the systems in place. They are the people that direct the system towards what it's supposed to be directed at. And in the case of Lansdale or Dulles or Trump, it's always the same thing. It's freewheeling capitalism. Those are the things that are being sold. That's what's being sold to the people of South Vietnam. And the way you sell it to them is you use their beliefs. All right, this is, gets to the nitty gritty. You tell them that communism is antithetical to their Confucian beliefs. Just like you tell Catholics that communism is antithetical to the belief in God. And then you can sell them communism because you're playing on their beliefs. And you tell the people of South Vietnam that, well, if you want to get off the farm and you want to come to the city, you got to you got to have better food. So you need our rice. You got to buy our rice. You got to get our vaccinations. You have to become an American if you want to be free. And they keep pounding this into the people. And of course, it didn't work in South Vietnam, because they didn't have the 200-year history that Americans have that's contributing, that makes them more manageable. And ultimately, so the systems that organizational systems, which I detail in my books, are brought home to the United States. Even though they don't work in South Vietnam, they're brought here, and they're used after 9/11 to construct the Department of Homeland Security. Okay, and the idea is that everybody's going to be terrified because terrorists are going to come after their freedoms. And it's another way of manipulating political and social institutions in order to make people do things that are against their own self-interest, to give up their own civil liberties, to engage in sectarian strife. And all these sorts of things start getting applied to the United States because at some point the CIA and the military realize they really can't do it to people of other cultures. They can't do it. It can't be applied in Iraq. It can't be applied in Afghanistan. I mean, you know, they tried and they tried and they tried to get the Taliban to reform, you know, and not be Muslims anymore, you know, and they try and they try to get the Sunnis not to be Muslims anymore. But all they can do is pit the Sunnis against the Shiites. I mean, that's what it comes down to. And so they realize that this is the essence of how they're going to control societies. And that's so they bring that whole system back here to the United States, to the Department of Homeland Security. And now they're just using the same methodology, the same bureaucratic systems to keep Americans fighting at each other while all their money goes to big corporations. And they and by playing on their beliefs, whether they're beliefs in Christianity, beliefs that in anti-communism, in militarism, the kind of things we were talking about, where the only way you can be a man is if you carry a gun and you kill your enemies. You know, the only way you can protect your wife and your kids is if you own a gun and you're a hard ass and a badass. All these beliefs are driven into our head relentlessly, every day in a thousand of different ways through, you know, what Guy Debord calls the spectacle. And Trump nowadays emerges like a rabbit out of a magician's hat to become the actual representation of this and bring it to its final fascist stage.
If we could, I want to pick your brain about this. You mentioned this idea of freedom, which is very important to Americans. It's bizarre to me when I hear the term freedom used in America at times, because I feel like what people it doesn't feel like freedom here. I mean, it doesn't feel like freedom to me that in order to be the ideal man, you have to be like John Wayne. That doesn't feel like freedom to me. It doesn't feel like freedom that we're reduced to just commodities. It's not freedom to me. And it just seems like there's been this successful psychological war to convince us that freedom is slavery.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, they have guys like Nelson Brigham, this organizational genius that are setting these things up. They you know, they know how to sell products. They know that, you know, certain advertisers advertise on Fox News because they pitch their products to people who have that ideology. Okay. And there's people who listen to Democracy Now! Because Amy Goodman has advertisers who, you know, pitch their products to her audience. And so the whole society is based on this free idea that free enterprise is the way to make you free. And that, you know, you have to then be hyper masculine and to defend this system. And that's how life is. OK. And it's very anti-intellectual. Where you see it more and more often all the time. And again, you see it with playing out now with this COVID-19 pandemic, where science is thrown out the door. People don't want to try to understand the science, and people in the media refer to what, you know, Trump saying magical thinking, it'll get better, it'll get better. Don't worry, just go back to work, save the economy. And people actually, based on their proclivities, based on the beliefs that are already instilled inside them, whether it's this idea that you have to abuse people to be man, or whether you believe in any abortion, or whether you believe that the only way you can be free is if there's no federal government, all these beliefs are there. There's nothing you can do to change people about them. What they're doing now is manipulating these beliefs in order to shame, disparage, diminish rational thinking, scientific thinking. And this COVID-19 pandemic is bringing that to the forefront, where rational thinking and scientific thinking are now mistrusted more than a huckster con man like Donald Trump. Okay, because people believe that their freedoms are at stake, their beliefs, their values are at stake, and they're so invested in these myths that they're willing to actually, like the people in South Vietnam, go against their own self, or really their own self-interest. They're willing to now go into a restaurant and have dinner with a bunch of other people, even though they might get infected with a terrible influenza and then bring it back and give it to their parents or people around them. There's no rationalism has been destroyed. Trump has absolutely destroyed any kind of belief in rational thinking. And people, to the extent now that people are, Fox News is telling people, they did it just two nights ago, to think militaristically. You have to think like a military hero now. You have to go out into society without a mask, and you have to get about your job, and you have to do all the things that you used to do, because that's how you save our free society.
They, you know, it's, I was just going to add, I've said to a few conservatives lately who said, oh, well, sometimes life has to be, there's more important things than life. We have to sacrifice our lives to keep the economy going. And I've always said to them, I'm like, you guys really forgot about Terry Schiavo.
I mean, let's get back to capitalism. In a capitalist society, labor is considered slavery. All right. Karl Marx, almost 200 years ago, 150 years ago, applied the scientific method to economics. Okay. And he very rationally approached how societies are organized economically and politically. And he said that for example, the Catholic Church is exploiting you. They're getting you to believe in myths so that you follow certain kinds of behaviors, you know, and that you believe that the Pope talks to God, you know, and that he became Pope because he was more devout and more holy than the cardinals, you know, and the cardinals are more holy and have a little bit more of a connection to God than the priests, you know, and if you as a individual Catholic want to talk to God, you got to go to church and talk to a priest, you know, and then they'll pass it up to the bishop, who passes it up to the cardinal, you know, passes it up to the Pope, and then eventually gets to the big guy, you know, and he's saying that's all bullshit. They're using this to keep you in slavery, these beliefs like that there's a the capitalist class knows more than you, and they're in that through Protestantism they have acquired their Vanderbilt or you know Boston Brahmin wealth because they're good Calvinists, and they're actually this is what Calvinism was, that, you know, they actually have millions of dollars because they're better people. They're more, you know, they're closer to God too. And that, you know, someday if you work hard enough, the myth that you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps, well, one day in a free society, you'll be rich too. All these things become part of the American mythology. They're all wrapped up together, and they're all sold like Ford sells cars through systems that are put in place, civic institutions, the Chamber of Commerce, you know, radio shows that are owned by corporations. The whole society is organized by people like Nelson Brigham in order to perpetuate these myths, so that because the ownership class owns all these systems and it puts them all in place in order to preserve its own you know, privileges, okay? And that's how we get into this situation. But frankly, like you say, the capitalists say one thing. They have a stated policy that we're giving you freedom, but at the same time, they consider you slaves. And nothing is making that contradiction more apparent. And people talk about it on alternative websites than the crisis that we're in right now, where Trump and Fox News are telling people, give up your lives. go back out into society, start living like nothing was wrong. And they're actually destroying and perverting the systems that were put in place to protect Americans from this kind of tyranny. A healthcare system, they destroyed Obamacare. They're telling you that you're not free if the federal government provides healthcare to you. You know, and people believe it. And they think, well, I'm going to go back home to someplace in Tennessee or Oklahoma, and everything's going to be fine because I got my gun and my Bible, and I got my job as a hairdresser or even as a lawyer or whatever, and it's all going to be good. And this is because these ideas and these beliefs are ingrained in them, and you can't do anything to shake them out of it. Our mandarins have really just created this situation, and it's intractable.
Before we close out the show, and I'm sorry we didn't get too deep into TDY. I think people should read the book, though. I don't want to give away too many plot details. The one thing I really wanted to ask you about at the end here is you, along with other researchers like Peter Dill Scott, have been broadly covering for decades now what's been called the deep state. And it's very interesting because I like the way you guys talk about the deep state, but I don't like the way that a lot of these Trump supporters talk about the deep state, because I don't think Trump is anti-deep state.
Well, no, of course he isn't, you know, and it's, you know, the deep state is fake news. You know, I mean, I was actually talking with Seymour Hersh, a couple of weeks ago, and he said, yeah, well, no, there really is a deep state, you know, but it serves his interests for people to believe that there's something magical going on, that there's, you know, some part of our society that is impenetrable or that you can't understand, but you can understand it all. You can and Peter Dale Scott talks about deep politics, but he also shows it and reveals it. He's not saying it's something that I can't talk about or I can't tell you about. He exposes it and he shows it, and it's there. And it shows you how, again, systems are put in place to protect the ruling class. Okay, and among those systems are things like the Drug Enforcement Administration. Okay, which is supposed to protect our public health by waging war on drugs. But actually, and as I show this in my books, it becomes a cover for CIA operations. It's a way for the CIA to control drug trafficking networks around the world. Okay, and you can say, just the same way that the CIA goes into South Vietnam and it says, we're going to conduct civic action programs. We're going to set up medical dispensaries for people in South Vietnam, and we're going to show them that, you know, we can vaccinate them for, we can give them malaria pills, we can do all these good things for them, and because we're giving them this, you know, medical aid, they're going to now support the South Vietnamese government, and at the same time, they're using these civic action programs, these medical dispensaries, to try to uncover where the Vietnamese cadre live. You know, they're using them to set up agent nets, okay? And my books show how this is, you know, the essence of what people think of as the deep state, the fact that the government is lying to you. It's telling you that it's doing you a favor when actually these systems that it's putting in place, the justice system, okay, is actually set up to protect people with money. And if you have no money, you can't get a lawyer. If you can't get a lawyer, you got to cop a plea, and then you go to jail. And then that is the reason why America has the largest prison population in the world. You know, it turns law enforcement into a profit-making enterprise, where the Justice Act, they call it the Justice Department, but actually it's a way of recycling Black people through the war on drugs into prison and disenfranchising them. And how this is what the deep state is. But you got to really examine it in these bureaucratic ways and see how our our rulers hire experts to set these systems up, the DEA, the FBI, the CIA, the media, all these things are set up, and they have a stated purpose, but in reality, they're doing very often the exact opposite of what they say they're doing. And that, in a sense, is what a deep state is. It's this impenetrable veil of secrecy and duplicity that you can't get through and see through unless you start reading books by people like me and Peter Dale Scott. And then all of a sudden, it's not a deep state anymore. You've pulled the veil, you know, you've seen who the Wizard of Oz is. And he's there, and anybody can see it. You just have to approach it scientifically and rationally and do the homework. And there really is no deep state. It's just the systems that the rulers have set up to confuse you and to lie to you and to get you to do things that are against your own self-interest.
On that note, before you go, what would you say? I'm assuming I have one or two listeners who are going to come across this, and they're going to be a Trump supporter, maybe. And I'm very adversarial with Trump supporters myself. But what would you say to a Trump supporter that believes, oh, Trump is fighting the deep state and the deep state hates him? What evidence would you give to say, no, he's part of this system?
You're not telling them anything they don't know. Okay, they understand. They understand all of this, everything that we're talking about instinctually. And representations are more important to them than the essence of the thing itself. So unless you can make them stop believing what they believe in, you have no chance, and you're not going to do that. Just like you're not going to, it's when you're born and you're born into a Muslim family, you become a Muslim. If you're born into a Jewish family, you become Jew. If you're born into a Christian family, you become a Christian. The only way that you can get out of any of those things is through really arduous and long self-critical examination of all your own beliefs. And nobody can convince anybody in the world to examine their own beliefs other than the person themselves. And there's nothing you can do to persuade anybody to give up Islam or Judaism or Catholicism or capitalism or communism or any belief that they may have. There's nothing you can do about it. So the only thing that you can really do is just try to, maintain your own equanimity. And as this chaos is raging around us, just to try to do the smart, rational, scientific thing and maybe by example, things will get better. But there's nothing you can say to anybody. People have to have some cathartic event like what happened to my father, in order to re-examine everything they believe in, go through some kind of mythic transformation, and achieve some sort of actual, achieve self-actualization. You have to go, people have to do that individually. And everybody knows that too. And in the meantime, it does no good to say these people aren't good or they're bad or something like that. Because as I explained earlier, a lot of them will run into a burning house to save their neighbor's kids, and they are capable of goodness and they do believe that they're good. It's not a question of good or bad or right or wrong. It's a transcendent spiritual battle that we're involved in, where we're battling a spectacle that's bigger than all of us put together.
Well, Douglas Valentin, I want to thank you for being a truth teller and a person who has for decades now pierced the veil, if I can use that metaphor. How can my listeners read your work? And maybe if you could just let them know a little bit about TDY and how they can get a hold of it.
Yeah, it's published by Clarity Press, which published my book, The CIA is Organized Crime. So one of the best ways to get it is to go to Clarity Press website or to go to my website, douglasvalentine.com, or to just, go to Google and put in Douglas Valentine TDY and Barnes & Noble and Amazon and all those places are selling it. And then in a few days, there's going to be an audio book available. It's a short book, so I was able to read it. And if you don't like reading, in a week or two, you'll be able to buy an audio book. I disavow all the mistakes that I made in it and my New York accent and all the other kind of flaws that may be in this audio book because I'm not a professional book reader, but I did read it.
And TDY, just for my listeners, we should have mentioned this earlier, that stands for temporary duty. And maybe if you could just let my listeners know just in brief what the basic outline of that book is.
Sure. It takes place in 1967. It's about a guy who I call Pete. It's based on a real story. And Pete works is a photojournalist on an Air Force base in early 1967. And he gets assignments off the base periodically. Living on an Air Force base and is really boring. And so periodically, as a photojournalist, he gets to go to other places around the country to do interviews and film people and photograph people and things like that. And he signs up for he's always on the TDY list. And one day he gets called into the personnel office and they say, we have a different kind of TDY mission for you. This time, this mission is going to involve a bit of secrecy, and you're going to have to sign a non-disclosure statement. But there's a big bonus and hazardous duty pay available, and we assure you that really it's not all that bad. But if you want to do it, sign up. And he signs up because the bonus is $2,000, which is like enough to buy a car. And he soon finds himself way over his head. And the book is an allegory, and it shows how Pete as an individual gets sucked into a secret covert intelligence gathering assignment, and how ultimately he becomes a captive in this assignment. It's not just that he's volunteered, but he's been shanghaied, hijacked, and he can't get out of it, and finds himself in a life-threatening situation. And when it's all over with, he's damaged for the rest of his life because he's made to sign this non-disclosure statement and he can't tell anybody about what happened. And he's actually gotten a firsthand view into what the criminality of the CIA and the true objectives of the military and the CIA and what they really are, and how it bothers him disturbs him and affects him for the rest of his life. And again, I'm saying it's an allegory because all of us have been hijacked. All of us are prisoners. You call it slaves. We're all prisoners of this war society. And it's not just that we're sworn to secrecy, but we don't even know that we're prisoners and we're so
traumatized by it.
Hmm?
I said, we're traumatized by it. We're all trauma victims almost in a way.
Yeah. And we're convinced that the trauma that we experience is heroism. We're made to actually think that somehow we're victims and of people in China or Iraq or communism in rather than our own I call it Mandarin rulers using us for their own purposes and filling our heads with all sorts of crazy nonsense that we all after generations thoroughly believe in and how we're all completely manipulated. And it's only by going through an experience like my father had in the prison camp and then, facing it, or going through an experience like this guy Pete had and then actually revealing it, that any one of us could confront the fact that we are, all of us, imprisoned by these beliefs that have been driven into our heads, and that, you know, it may be a comfortable life that a lot of us live, and we may fight to defend it, but, you know, it's not to our own, it's really not in our self-interest to be doing this.
Well, Douglas Valentine, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views.
Oh, it's always fun to talk with you, and I enjoy your show.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Douglas Valentine, author of the recently republished PDY, as well as the excellent The Phoenix Program. Give those books a read, and let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. And of course, if you can, please consider supporting me on Twitter, where you will be able to get a video version of this very interview with Douglas Valentine, as well as bonus content such as the Parallax Views Ranting Current Events program, The Week That Was with my pal Casey, and much, much more. You can get all that great bonus content at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.